Welcome to Film Forum's podcast. The following event was recorded on September 20th, 2014, live at our theaters located at 209 West Houston Street in Manhattan.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Film Forum. Thanks so much for coming out on this sunny afternoon. My name is Mike Maggiore. I do programming for the premieres here with Karen Cooper. And it's our great pleasure to welcome you to the special screening of 20,000 Days on Earth. We're very excited to have the filmmakers Jane Pollard and Ian Forsythe with us. They're going to join us after the film to take your questions. Ian and Jane met at Goldsmiths College in London and studied visual art. They come from an art background. This is their feature film debut. They're kind of best known for recreations of seminal moments in pop culture history. They did one very striking piece that was a recreation of David Bowie's final appearance as Ziggy Stardust on his 25th anniversary. And I think you're going to see some of that influence in how they handle this film. They began working with Nick Cave on his album Dig Lazarus Dig, and making some music videos, and did a series of short films for a re-release of his entire catalog with the Bad Seeds. And I think that they've created something that's wholly unique. It's really avoiding a lot of the pitfalls of the rock film. It's not a concert movie. It's not a fly-on-the-wall group portrait, and it's not a behind-the-scenes traditional rock documentary with a lot of archival footage and talking heads. It's very much its own animal, and really nothing less than an exploration of creative inspiration. So it's really our honor to have the film here as an exclusive run. And we will see you afterwards in 97 minutes. Thanks. Please welcome the directors of 20,000 Days on Earth, Ian Forsythe and Jane Pollard.
Hello, hello.
I guess we should just start by talking about, I mentioned in the introduction that you started working with Nick Cave around the Dig Lazarus Dig album. And I was just wondering if we could start by talking about how you approached him with this idea, or if he approached you about filming and turning this into a feature.
It's kind of almost any question you can ask about this film, the answer is kind of like bit of this, bit of that. Like the entire project has been like that. So the kind of beginning was a very sort of unplanned. There was no big, basically Nick and Warren began working on writing the record that ended up being Push the Sky Away. And Nick called one day and said, look, I'm about to begin this project. Why don't you guys come and spend some time with us while we're doing it and bring some cameras? And Nick has never done that before. You know, we've done stuff in the studio with him, but it's like,
and imagine at this point he had been asked many times to participate in a documentary,
sure,
right?
Yeah. And I mean, it, you know, there wasn't even a documentary in mind. I think Nick just kind of somehow instinctively knew that there was something going on with this record that was going to be different. You know, the band had kind of changed quite a bit since the last time they recorded. Mick Harvey had left the band. Mm-hmm. So the guitar as an instrument had kind of taken a bit of a backseat in how they were writing. And I think he just kind of had this feeling that something important somehow was going to happen with this record and liked the idea of trying to capture that. So we began filming, and there was no sort of discussion of what we would do with it or where it would end up or what the project might be. And it was kind of through the process of doing that and starting to look back at what we had that it just sort of felt to us like, for that to disappear into a sort of sea of YouTube, kind of, you know, endless kind of vacuum of content that every band is kind of under pressure by record companies to produce these days. That just felt really unworthy of these moments that we've been able to capture. So that's when we began to talk about what the kind of the bigger vessel for this material might be in the film.
For me, it really happened when the French school kids were in the studio. That was when I knew we had something way more than we couldn't just make a small thing. We had to make something big. And I think it's because I had, we each had a microphone. So Ian would have Nick in one ear on a little collar mic. And then we'd have a room mic each in the other ear. And I had Warren in my ear, and I heard the whole conversation about three couldn't juggle, you know, the two careers of wanting to run a choir and heroin, and that's where and it was that kind of these layers of things all happening at once, and I thought, God, there's just something much more in this. We felt that real urge to shape something bigger, but you know, we come from a background where we're not the kind of people who are going to make a conventional music doc, and Nick, as you say, has turned down hundreds of them. So we knew we had to make something different.
Mm-hmm. And one of the sequences I think that really anchors the film is the interview with Damien Leader, who's a psychoanalyst. Can you talk a little bit about how you decided to bring him into this? And
sure, yeah.
And I understand that there was a lot of footage shot with him.
We shot with him for 2 days. So we have, I think, about 10 hours of Nick and Darian talking. And he's a psychoanalyst by trade. That's what he does professionally. And he's a friend of ours. We knew him from back in our days when we were at art school. We met him. And he was, I think for us, he was a way of being able to, for the film to speak to Nick in a non-journalistic kind of way. You know, I think anyone that knows anything about Nick, you know, almost the one thing that everyone knows is that he has this kind of quite troublesome relationship with the media. And it was kind of obvious that sitting him down with a journalist was not going to generate an interesting conversation. So we began to talk about other ways that we could tease something out of Nick. And Darian, we just kind of thought because of his background, he would have a way of making a conversation that would be interesting. The thing with Nick, the real secret, I mean, if there's any secret to making this film, the secret to getting the best out of Nick is to make it interesting for him. It's as simple as that. You know, if he gets bored, he gets distracted, his mind wanders, he wants to be somewhere else, and you've kind of lost him and nothing happens.
You're making him sound like a 3-year-old child.
I've got no comment to make about that. So the thing that Darian was able to do that I think, you know, the kind of the usual kind of media format of journalism doesn't really do was give Nick a conversation that was interesting to him. Darian was able to kind of bring back to the table things that Nick had not thought about to think about. I mean, there was a beautiful, beautiful long conversation that they had that was of no use for the film at all because it would have taken far too much explaining. But Darian had kind of begun to see these associations between Nick's two novels. The way that the lead characters in both die, Euclid in and the Ass or the Angel, disappears into quicksand, and Bunny Munro in The Death of Bunny Munro is killed in a car accident. Right?
Then struck by lightning.
By lightning. And Darian managed to kind of draw all these associations between those two deaths and the experience of heroin. Which was a really, really fascinating conversation, and Nick was, you know, really interested in what Darian had to say. It was no use for the film at all, but that the fact that they could kind of engage on that level meant that Nick kind of had a rapport, and out of that we were able to get the material that ultimately was useful.
Some of those bits we're going to stick on the DVD. Like we've taken some, there's so much stuff that we couldn't use and stuff that really only would be of interest to a fan. Mm-hmm. And we wanted the film to speak to a much broader audience. So, but we've got quite a bit of that kind of that'll go out on the DVD.
Oh, that's exciting.
There's just bits that we, you know, we remember, there's just bits we remembered and it was like, oh my God, you remember that?
I want to get to questions from the audience. So if you have a question, just raise your hand. Jorge, we'll pass the microphone around.
Anything, no holds
Anything.
Barred. How bad can it be?
Right there in the middle. The question was, is this DVD available? I can say no, it is not yet available.
Yeah, no, no.
Oh, sorry, I've said it.
Yeah. No, it's okay. It's just the movie has a theatrical release first.
When he talks, or is it all improvised?
The question is there a script when Nick Cave talks, or is it all improvised?
Yes and no.
I told you that was going to be the answer.
There was a script, but the script had no dialogue in it. So we had an action script. Yeah, we knew which scene, we knew where we were, we knew what he was doing, we knew what that place would look like and what roughly was going to happen in it. But what we didn't know was what was going to be said. even roughly what was going to be said. Everything is improvised. So even the car drives, all the car scenes, they're all they're much quicker. So the Darien psychoanalyst scene in the archive, they were 2 days, 10 hours of each. You know, we talked about loads of stuff. You know, it just improvised for hours. And we never let Nick do anything twice because he's really wooden the second time he does it. We tried once and it's just, you know, you can't ask him to repeat something. It just becomes kind of self-conscious. He's great at being in the moment. And so we'd only ever do things once, which meant there was great stuff said that had to get lost because of a technical problem, you know, a sound issue or whatever. And that made the car scenes the scariest because they were filmed in about 20 minutes each. They were a 10-minute route around Brighton, and we did it twice. And if we didn't get it, that we just had to leave it because there's no way you can keep two people kind of talking in a car for longer than that without it getting super awkward. So they were really scary and a big ask on our crew, you know, to shoot like that. To have so little control.
Actually, right here.
Just surprised, you mentioned about the writing and that the part that you mentioned that psychoanalysis was following Nick's in his two novels. I was a bit surprised that there was no mention of the novel, the writing part of Nick Cave's, because I think it probably plays a big role in his later career. Was it intentional, or you just felt that it was not part of the story they wanted to tell? There was no mention of those two books anywhere.
He did talk about them in the psychoanalyst thing and in the archive. They just didn't work. I mean, you know, you have 90 odd minutes, and we didn't want to make a super long film. You're trying to make the kind of best of what you have, and that meant cutting. That meant some really tough decisions about cutting stuff out and taking stuff out that we just couldn't use. We have amazing material about his use of words and his connection to language, and again, some of this will go on the DVD, and all of that came out. So so all the stuff about the novels came out too. I mean, the thing that we told ourselves when we were making this was that we gave ourselves a total free pass to not tell the truth at all. Just to not be, to not feel politically tied to making sure that every past band member was mentioned, to trying to be fair in a kind of the way that the current band is presented, any of that. It was like, if we're going to try and do something really different, we can't be strung to kind of things like that, because that's, you know, once you're there, you may as well kind of tie your feet down. You can't move. You've got no room to go anywhere. So we just became untethered, and in that, you make those hard decisions. And sometimes you forget, like when you said that, there's no mention of the novels, and I'm like, is there nothing? Like, really? Like, God, nothing stayed in? Yeah. Because I feel like they're in there because they were at many parts, and maybe for us also the car scenes are so influenced by the death of Bonnie Monroe, which Ian and I produced the audiobook for, so we know that novel inside out, and the car scenes for us are hugely stolen from Nick, and the way that the Fiat Punto works in that novel for us is very much the way that those scenes work in this film. They operate in a similar sort of psychological bubble type of a space, yeah.
Okay, there was one in back. Yes.
Well, as long as you've said no holds barred, let me ask a sort of gee, that was neat. How do you make a movie question? coming back to the car scenes, particularly watching the conversation with, I'm afraid I don't know his name, the actor with the Cockney accent and the beard.
Ray Winston.
Just watching it cut back between shots that appeared to be with the camera set up on the hood of the car with nobody in the car, to shots of Mr. Winston from Cave's point of view, even though there had been no camera apparent, and even though it seemed to be the same question. Talk a little about how that was set up and how you produced something as seamless as that.
Sure.
It was one of many things, by the way, that made the movie really cinematic, which I think, for me, was the best thing about it.
Thank you. I mean, Ray Winston, for anyone who doesn't know, played one of the lead characters in The Proposition, which is the film that Nick wrote for John Hillcoat. John Hillcoat made, and Ray and Guy Pearce and Danny Houston were the leads. So that's kind of, that's why kind of Ray was there, I guess. So to answer the technical question, the kind of one thing we had with Ray that we didn't really have with anyone else at all connected to the film was a trained actor. He has that kind of skill, and it's a skill that Nick certainly doesn't have. And you know, no one else really on camera was. So uniquely in that scene, what we were able to do was, after we'd shot the scene, was get everything re-rigged, get the cameras into the car, do the route again, and have Ray do his lines again for the camera. So
we just, on the first drive round, we wrote down the bits that we really liked that Ray had improvised, and we just noted them down, and then we camera in, and actually I'm lying on the back seat at that point, feeding him his lines, going like, and trying to remember the intonation that he used, and feeding him the lines.
Which, of course, Ray was completely able to do. You could say, could you say this line? And this is, we were literally playing him back in his ear what he'd said, and he could say it again. And, you know, if we'd have done that with Nick, it would have been absolutely disastrous. But you use what you've got, right?
Right. Yes.
Hi. It was a great movie. Loved it. I was watching the car scenes also. I was wondering if there was any guests that didn't make the cut.
Yes and no. The three people we really wanted all said yes, and they're there. That is who we wanted. We did try and film Susie, Nick's wife, in the back of the car, just appearing kind of in glances in the mirror. And it's funny, the more we showed of Susie, the less presence she had in the film. It was a real weird thing that happened. And we tried filming maybe four different things. Her in the rear view mirror, when the car was static, when the car was moving. We tried her in a mirror, another mirror, and it just, none of it worked. It was the only things we rejected in the whole thing, that the more we showed her, even in reflection, the presence didn't, she
it
didn't
kind of normalized her.
Yeah, it made
she
her normal.
A thing, a person. And I think her presence in the film hopefully is a little closer to how she is. I think in Nick's kind of the creative world that he talks about in the film is, you know, Susie is all over that last record. That last record is kind of entirely about her, but there's nothing, you know, there isn't a line that says, and Susie said this, and Susie did that. It's not a kind of literal interpretation of their life together. And it kind of felt that by pulling Susie back into a kind of more ethereal presence. I think the scene in the archive when Nick talks about first meeting Susie and the kind of the overload of erotic data that kind of flooded through him at that moment, to me feels like it kind of really gets to the essence of their relationship and how Nick feels about her.
Okay, there's one right here in the aisle.
When did you know that Brighton was going to have such a presence? I mean, and certainly that last shot, was that, did you know that in advance, or did it happen during the filming?
Sorry. Right. I mean, we kind of knew Brighton was going to play a fairly big role because it's where Nick lives. And again, as with sort of Susie being all over the last record, Brighton too is a play, you know, what's the song called? The Water's Edge. And there's a whole bunch of songs on that record that really quite, Jubilee Street is a street in Brighton. It's not the street that Nick thought it was. We found out afterwards, that, which is kind of funny. But by that point, he'd kind of written it, and Jubilee Street worked for the rhymes and whatever. And, you know, anyway, that aside, Brighton, I think, has become a big part of this kind of imaginative world that Nick, as a songwriter, kind of dwells in. So all the kind of places around that you see in the film really are kind of part
also
of that,
that
world.
That idea, there was two things that we really loved about it. We had the last scene from the beginning, we always knew what that last scene was. And we actually, that came to us when Warren played us the demo of Push the Sky Away, the song, just after they recorded it, after they first demoed it. And we were in the control room listening, and we were like, oh my God, it sounds like you're standing on the edge of the world, like on a precipice. And that was when we were like, okay, well, you know, that's how we've got to do that one then. Had always thought Push the Sky Away would be what you heard, though. And the other thing is that Brighton is, the weather changes constantly. It's like right on a sort of, you know, it's the edge of the country, and you get amazing weather.
I think we just have time for one more question right here.
Yes. You alluded to this a little bit earlier, but I wonder if you could talk more about how and why you chose to do the interviews in a car in this sort of nebulous space, and what that specifically speaks to about him or his work.
It's kind of hard to explain without going through the entire story of the death of Bunny Munro, which I'm not going to do here, but kind of in brief, in the book, The Death of Bunny Munro, Bunny Munro is a traveling salesman, anyone who hasn't read it, and he, early in the book, his wife dies, there you go, spoiled it, sorry. And Bunny Munro drives around Brighton with his son, Bunny Jr., in the car, and they drive around whilst he's working, and Bunny goes door-to-door selling stuff. So there's a lot of scenes in the car where Bunny Jr., who I think is about 9, he's the same age that Nick's twins were at the point that he was writing the book, and Bunny Jr. is left in the car on his own a lot. And so there's quite a lot of passages in the book where you learn a lot about the kind of inside of Bunny Jr.'s mind, his thought processes and what he's thinking about his father and about losing his mother and about what he kind of sort of suspects his father is up to whilst he's meant to be selling things door to door. And it kind of gives this very sort of internalized space. It felt like it was a very sort of what's the word?
Psychological. No.
That'll do. And we really liked that idea, that it was kind of a place that it felt like we could be quite playful. It felt like somewhere that we didn't have to be quite so kind of honest in our filmmaking, that we could...
I'm going to try, right? You really... Also, you're looking off always for ways of bringing out different voices. Like, you know the way, if you go to the bar, do you have pubs here? Pubs here. Go to the pub with your mates. You're different. The way you talk, your voice is different to the way you speak to your mum on the phone. You know, these are different sides of you. And we needed to bring these out in Nick. And so that was the idea, was about using characters that do that. Ray Winston, you cannot. He cuts through all the crap. He's a such no bullshit kind of guy. And he's also not really in awe of Nick. Like, he doesn't. Even a lot of Nick's friends, I mean, me included, you're not quite in awe of him. He's got a real presence, and you can get a bit kind of wrong-footed around him sometimes. It's not always easy just to tell him to shut up. But Ray has that. That was a really nice kind of disarming side of Nick that we wanted to bring out. And Kylie, it's an utter tender, nostalgic thing. You know, that relationship's really special, and they don't see each other very often. So when they do, you just get something really lovely with them. And then Blixer was the kind of wild card. We'd seen them together since Blixer left. We'd been in the same room when they'd seen each other. They had talked, but they'd never talked about why he left the band, which actually happened in an email. He left the band in an email to Nick. And
he left the band in, what, 2003 or so? Yeah, he'd been with the Bad Seeds for about 20 years.
Yeah, well, founding member, yeah. And he... And it was only like a 2-line email, and I think Nick either emailed him back or phoned and said, "Are you sure?" and didn't get a response, and that was that. And they'd never talked about it. Nick was gutted. I mean, Blixer meant the world, and we thought, let's. I mean, Blix is just interesting. I mean, you don't even have to say anything, and he's interesting. So we knew something could come out of that kind of meeting. And that was the only thing we primed, the only time we primed Nick with anything, was just as he was kind of walking to the car. And we always kept Nick apart from whoever we were filming them with beforehand, so that they couldn't, you know, he didn't meet Darian until it was on set, on camera. Same with Kylie, we kept them apart. He got into the, he was heading to the car with Blixer, and we said, try and ask him why he left the band then. Like, in a, it's like a, you know, if you can, if, you know, and Nick was like, well, if it comes up, I'll see what I can do. And so it was this real offhand kind of, yeah, see, just ask him about that. And fortunately, we managed to, you know, we managed to get there. Yeah.
Kind of.
Yeah. Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, but thanks so much for coming, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Film Forum's podcast. Visit us online at filmforum.org, where you can learn more about our films, memberships, subscribe to our free weekly e-newsletter, and to find out the ways you can support our nonprofit cinema. And if you have the time, please visit our iTunes page and leave a rating and review of our podcasts. Copyright to this program belongs to The Moving Image Incorporated.